Okay, we have our third argument for the day. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Good afternoon. Before we begin, I want to introduce our panel members. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutter. It's my understanding that everybody has checked in. Ready? Would the clerk please call the case?
Good afternoon, may I please the court? This case challenges the constitutionality of Article 38.37, Section 2B of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. We raised both a facial challenge as well as an as-applied challenge. I know the state, in its responsive briefs, has entered into the argument about whether the facial challenge was preserved or not. I would submit to the court, first of all, we don't agree with that, but in this case, I don't believe it's necessary for the court to reach that question because if it found the statute was unconstitutional as applied, it would not need to reach the facial challenge. The first question the court is going to have to consider now, we know when we cited, in fact, I cited in my opening brief, the fact that this particular statute is derived from a national conference that was went outside the ordinary rulemaking process on the federal level. I cited some law regarding as we discussed that, the fact that the Judicial Council of the United States strongly opposed this rule when it was adopted by Congress, and it did not go through the ordinary peer review of academics, the ABA. In fact, every legal organization that I know of, whether it's the ABA or the Federal Judicial Council, opposed this rule strongly, because it was such a radical departure from what has been the law since the 1600s.
The law is the law, or do we take I want you to tell me why it's unconstitutional. Why should we throw this law out?
Okay, all right. Number one, the court's going to need to address the question of whether the protections against propensity evidence of a third party, because we're not talking about a situation where the same victim's testifying about the same conduct towards them as the victim in an indictment. We're talking about third parties, and that's what Section 2B actually does, is it goes beyond what was existing law prior to and says that the admissibility of extraneous propensity evidence dealing with a third party that's not named in the indictment shall be admissible. The reason why is constitutional. Number one, you have to determine whether it's a fundamental constitutional right, that is, in fact, a protection against propensity evidence under these circumstances. The intermediate courts of appeals in Texas that have considered, I believe one of them assumed arguendo or even said that yes, it's a fundamental right. The others kind of assumed arguendo or some branch didn't even address it at all, because the reason why that's important is because you determine then whether a compelling argument or legitimate purpose that the government overrides the fundamental right in narrow exceptions, or if it's not a fundamental right, then you have a more deferential standard. Once you determine whether, and of course I provide authority going back to the 1600s in England as well as the United States, starting at about 1761, this kind of decision, and comments by the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts that it is a fundamental constitutional right. Once you reach that, then you get to the question that was addressed in Coy versus Iowa by the United States Supreme Court, as well as Long versus State. Both of those cases dealt with confrontation as a fundamental constitutional right under the federal constitution, and said even if you claim you have a compelling governmental interest, you have to make that determination on a case-by-case basis. Coy and Long were both cases where the Sixth Amendment was found to have been violated by closed circuit TV testimony or screens being placed in between the defendant and the child witness. And in the U.S. Supreme Court case, Coy versus Iowa, and in the Long case dealing with the video testimony, both the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas as well as the U.S. Supreme Court said you can't do a blanket rule like this particular statute does, where it just applies without an individual determination of whether the witness really would be harmed or not harmed in the particular case. There was no finding in this court, there was no argument made by the state. In fact, in this case, the child or adult recounting things that happened 20 years ago testified by Avery, that is H.W., who was named in the indictment. And there's just no showing that there was some harm or trauma or anything occurring to her that prevented her from testifying, because she actually did testify. So, number one, the court, you can narrow this down, as applied, you could narrow it down to saying that the statute survives because from here on out it's going to have an individualized assessment. Or you can say that you just can't read that restriction into the statute. Either way, it wasn't applied in this case. That was that kind of a determination of individualized harm of the child victim witness. Therefore, we're going to also do a trial. The arguments that have been made and the rationales that were relied upon by the other Texas courts of appeals that have addressed it, and also the people's choice authority, are what are known as the procedural safeguards. I don't know what exactly they mean by safeguards, but none of the procedural safeguards safeguard to prevent someone being convicted by the defense of the evidence. So if you get notice 30 days in advance that you're going to be convicted by prior defense of the evidence, you get a hearing where you get to learn more about how you're going to be convicted based upon defense of the evidence unconstitutional. The court then has to make a finding that if the witness can just utter the words, he did it, that it's a third party child who's not even named in the indictment says he did it. Courts are not able or not permitted to make a credibility determination as long as there's any testimony at all by which a jury could determine that the extraneous propensity evidence is true beyond a reasonable doubt. It comes in. So that doesn't even prevent a jury. And then, of course, you've got rule. I do agree with the courts that found Rule 403 continues to apply, because the statute not only mentions 404, I believe 405, but even under 403, you don't get any protection or safeguard to prevent a jury from convicting you based upon this propensity evidence and not the evidence in the case you're charged with, because the more prejudicial the extraneous propensity evidence, the stronger the grounds for its admissibility. So it turns Rule 403 on its head. If you're doing this balancing test under 403, and the way it used to apply, the more prejudicial or harmful it would be, the more likely it would be excluded. This statute turns it around completely, the 180, where the more prejudicial, the more similar the offenses are, and all those sorts of things that would ordinarily go to exclude that testimony, is now made more admissible and actually becomes a ground to allow its admission over an objection. So 403 doesn't provide any safeguard. And then, of course, there's other things the court could do. It could give a limiting instruction, but in this case, the limiting instruction would have to track the statute and say, you can consider the fact that the third party witness for which the defendant's not on trial, you can consider her testimony when you find or determine whether somebody's guilty for the actual charge of offense. So that would be, first of all, probably a comment on the way the evidence, even though it would be the only kind of instruction you'd be entitled to under the statute.
So the as-applied challenge is unconstitutional in your mind because it violates the right to confrontation?
No, it's not confrontation. It's the fundamental constitutional right not to be determined guilty or not guilty on the basis of extraneous prior misconduct, including prior offenses, that does not involve the person named in the indictment as a victim.
Okay, so there's no confrontation argument being made. I heard you talk about it, you said it implicated it.
Well, no. The analysis, the cases Coy versus Iowa and Long versus State that I mentioned, both of those were confrontation cases. I was referring to them only for the purpose of the analysis that has to be applied. The lower courts in Long and the lower courts in Coy versus Iowa.
So you're really hanging your argument on a fundamental right not to be convicted on propensity evidence.
That's correct.
A facial challenge, correct?
I'm sorry?
It's really the facial challenge.
Well, I don't think you have to get to the facial challenge. In this case, I would be inclined to agree with the state that I did not enumerate or specifically referred to a facial challenge. I did have a motion for new trial. However, I'm kind of going to concede, because it was denied by operation of law, and I never got into a record proof that the trial court received it, although I did. He's passed away, so I can't really call him as a witness to come talk to you. But I'm not worried about the facial challenge. If you decide the question on the as-applied, it would necessarily resolve the facial challenge in this particular case. If you found my client's constitutional rights were violated as applied, he would get a new trial, and it wouldn't make any difference if you determined for other people whether it was facial or invalid. You know what I'm saying?
Give me an example, counsel. I don't want to box you in. Would you give me an example? Assuming that the court was to find it on its face that the statute is constitutional, the case, an example of a case where it would have been applied in a constitutional manner.
Well, okay, but it's an open argument. Whether if this statute was construed to require the trial court to only allow admissibility based upon a showing and a finding with a burden on the state that the individual child victim named in the indictment could not adequately testify because of trauma or other such things. That was a criteria that was the deciding factor in Coy versus Iowa dealing with confrontation, but the same analysis. That was a criteria that the Court of Criminal Appeals turned on in Long versus State, because the statute did not say you can do this only if the child victim named in the indictment is traumatized. And this statute doesn't require that. It's basically, they can call anybody in. Of course, this trial, actually the third party non-victim witness of the extraneous propensity evidence, had no problem at all testifying. In fact, over half the trial testimony was her testifying. My client hadn't been charged with anything concerning her. And so it was basically, and actually, if you look at the bill analysis, that's really the purpose that the state had. And the arguments in favor of this is we can't convict people if we can't follow the prohibition against propensity evidence.
But the bill analysis isn't the law.
Well, no, I'm not saying it is, but I think if
what we have to look at is the law.
I'm trying to go beyond that. If there's any ambiguity about the purpose of this bill, it's everywhere. It's in state bill analysis, it's in congressional reports, it's in 100 different law review articles.
But you can put anything you want to in the congressional reports, counsel.
Okay, all right. We wouldn't have to show intent anyway. We don't have to show effect. And in this case, there's no dispute at all that the effect of this happening, that is the admission of this propensity evidence, it contributed. You can't say beyond a reasonable doubt it did not contribute to my client's conviction. Obviously, I mean, it's common sense to tell you the reason why you put on third-party testimony is so you can bolster what might be a less strong or weaker case if you just make it depend on the testimony of the victim and any other eyewitnesses to the actual offense named in the indictment. But in this, under this statute, you can bring in as many people as you want. They can say 20, 25 years ago he did the exact same thing to me. And so it has a better semblance to what has been a fair trial in the last 300 years.
If you say that the fundamental right not to be convicted on propensity evidence dates back hundreds of years,
according to Whitmore, it was 319, so it's probably a little more than that now.
What's your best case in, let's say, this millennium? Or maybe just the last two millennia?
The two courts of last resort, that Supreme Courts of Iowa and Missouri, one is the Ellison decision of Missouri, and an identical rule adopted based to follow on the federal rule.
They both say it's a fundamental
right. It's a fundamental right, and it's blatantly unconstitutional because it's saying I can't convict on the evidence I got, so I need to change the Constitution so I can convict. That's basically the argument. And that's what's talked about in the report that the representatives and senators in Austin read or had constructive notice of when they voted to enact this statute. And if there's no other questions, I see my yellow lights on. I'll reserve. No problem.
Thank you.
Regardless of what appellant's counsel has said to each of the justices, this is essentially what he's putting forth is a facial challenge to the law. And the problem with that is, as he has conceded, he has waived a facial challenge to the statute. It has to be raised at the trial court, and he would have not done so in this case. He did say several times that he was challenging it as applied. However, for the argument, whether or not he preserved that error, though, I don't want to spend my time on that. Even if he preserved the error, 3837 does not violate the constitutional rights of the appellant. You look at the purpose of the statute and the bill analysis, you know, it's to address the unique challenges in prosecuting child sexual assault cases, because children are often targeted for sexual assault cases because they tend to make forward. And it also aligns with Texas law with the federal law. But with the exception, with the difference being that the Texas law is more restrictive by quite a bit than the federal law. The federal law allows for offenses against both adults and minors. You know, the federal law, it doesn't have to be similar offenses. In the state of Texas, the law says that only offenses against minors may come in a trial of a case against a minor for a similar type of offense. And so it's much more restrictive. And there are these constitutional safeguards that have been put in place by the law, requiring notice 30 days in advance of trial, that there has to be a pretrial hearing where the judge hears the testimony and rules that a testimony that he heard could prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a rational jury that the testimony itself of this extraneous offense is true. The defendants don't have a fundamental right to be free from the introduction of extraneous offenses in the state of Texas. You look at 404B. You know, we have many times where extraneous offenses may become relevant in trial for specifically in purpose. And under that statute, there doesn't even have to be a finding of the ability to prove beyond a reasonable doubt prior to it coming into evidence. It has to be limited to instruction. The courts start saying that they have to believe it beyond a reasonable doubt before they can consider it. And that, I mean, same limiting instruction was given in this case by court start. Also, under Section 31.03 of the Penal Code, the theft statute allows that recent similar thefts are admissible in the guilt stage, and they don't have to be against the same victim. And they're admissible to show knowledge and intent. And so those are just two examples where we already have laws that allow extraneous offense evidence into the trial court at the guilt stage. Now, no Texas court has held that Article 3837 is unconstitutional. There are no controlling authorities for the appellant's argument in this case. This is a procedure that is fair to defendants. Defendants are afforded due process in the pretrial hearing and notice an opportunity to be heard on that issue before the court makes its determination. Defendants are allowed to hear the testimony of the victims before trial and opportunity to investigate that testimony prepared for cross-examination of that testimony, and the state still has to prove every element of the charge document beyond a reasonable doubt. Now you look at, as it's applied in this case, we already mentioned the limiting instruction, but as it's applied, the fact in this case were one of the elements, one of the offenses alleged was the two counts, one of them was aggravated sexual assault of the child. The fact in that case was that the child was in the towel and the defendant was supposed to wrestling with the child, and during that the defendant's fingers penetrated the vagina of the child, female sexual organs. In that case, it puts on an issue absence of mistake and intent, which even under the theory of without the statute, could have been admissible under 404. name, as one of the main things in 404B that they can be introduced, which is absence of a state, and also for intent. Now, we have some case law that is authoritative to this court. One is Martin's case, in which the Second Court of Appeals was talking about 3837 prior to the amendment, which included and that was, it said that prior bad, talking about prior bad is passed against the same child, not different children, the same child. The court noted that special circumstances surrounding the sexual assault of a child victim outweigh normal concerns associated with evidence of extraneous acts. Article 3837 does not violate due process. That was the statement of this court. And the Gregg court, cited Martin, and this is a post change in the statute, and saying that due process in that case, so that due process was not violated, both state and federal courts have determined that the admission of extraneous offense evidence does not implicate a fundamental right. Federal Rule 402 and 413 are not unconstitutional because of their safeguards. That there's a rational basis for 3837, including sexual assault cases are unique. They often don't have any scientific evidence and are largely based on testimony. And the special circumstances of sexual assault of a child case outweigh the normal concerns associated with evidence of extraneous acts. Now, a recent case that is authoritative, although not controlled in this group, came out of the Eastern Personal Church, Buxton case, that was just decided in July of this year, which specifically analyzed 3837 Section 2D. And said that the safeguards do not violate due process and that 3837 TV is not unconstitutional. Now, there's also the fact that this case has come under fire. I mean, this statute has come under fire. There's not been any of the courts in the state of Texas and no controlling courts in the federal courts that have ruled that it is, that Rule 413 federal version of the statute is unconstitutional. There's no authority to say that it is unconstitutional and plenty to say that it is and it does not violate the process. I will get back on time. Thank you very much. You guys, unless you have a question.
Thank you.
Okay. To clarify the record, the state in its brief, and I believe just now in its argument, has acknowledged that there's no problem. No dispute that we did preserve the as applied challenge. I just think that was great. I've stated it, but I think the statement as well. I don't think they have to reach professional because if you decide either way, that would basically make it unnecessary to decide the facial challenge. Now, with regard to, I find this to be a very important case because you do. Regardless of what the outcome is in this case, for you or on a petition for discretionary review of Court of Criminal Appeals, I consider it to be highly likely the U.S. Supreme Court will resolve this because you've got two state courts in last resort that have ruled contrary to the intermediate state court that the state relies on in this case. So you would have what's called a horizontal conflict, and because this is a rule that has been adopted following Congress's lead all over the country, about 30% space in that, so it's going to have to be resolved ultimately by the U.S. Supreme Court, so I do think it's a very important thing. With regard to the absence of the state, that's an exception that would only apply after the state had rested its case in chief. That is, if a defendant got on the stand and raised the question of the state, then it would be appropriate to take into consideration whether the extraneous offense or propensity evidence might be admissible because the defense raised a question of the state. That's not what we've got here. We've got an objection outside the presence of the jury during the state's case in chief, even beforehand, and then being overruled and the state then putting on this propensity third-party testimony or extraneous testimony. county. But some decision was actually initially decided in January, it decided in October, a subsequent decision in July came out on a hearing, it did not change substantially its analysis. Can't remember exactly why they found it necessary to do another opinion on the hearing, but to my recollection, it did not change any of its analysis. We're only dealing with this particular statute, the fact that there might be the basis for a similar challenge with regard to other statutes. It's kind of, it hasn't been briefed, it's not something that's occurred to me to think about. But the fact that, well, first of all, the federal constitution does apply to the state of Texas, and the fact that the state thinks that the state of Texas permits it, that decides the question, is not really the issue for the court. You don't do that in federal due process claims. That's the basis on which we're relying. Unless the court has any other questions, they would be asked to decide.
No, no, thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, your case has been submitted, and,
Hey, what?